Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we get started, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, the presenting sponsor of RAISE, the event fundraising conference. OneCause invites you to join them at RAISE, being held this year in Washington, D.C. on September 14th and 15th. RAISE brings together hundreds of fundraising professionals, industry experts and nonprofit speakers to share insights and network with others innovating in the world of fundraising. To join the community of fearless fundraisers attending RAISE and to learn more about the conference, please visit www.onecause.com/responsive50. That's www.onecause.com/responsive50. Hi, Stephen. Thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I talked earlier this week, and I'm excited because we're going to talk about donor-advised funds, which we're creeping up on 125 episodes, and I don't think we've talked about them. So before we do that, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. Thanks, Jason. It's a real pleasure to be on the show today, and absolutely. My career has taken a couple turns, but I've interacted with donor advised funds on a couple different fronts. First, being a nonprofit and philanthropic consultant with a boutique firm in Atlanta, working with foundations and high net worth individuals. And most of them used donor advised funds. And so from a consultant perspective, that's where I first encountered them. And then most recently, the last couple years, I've been working on a venture that is trying to democratize donor advised funds away just from high net worth individuals and trying to roll out a product that will bring donor advised funds to everyone. So that's a little bit of my story. And so we've gotten to know a lot of the donor advised funds players in the industry and are excited about, you know, where donor advised funds might take philanthropy in the future.
Yeah. So let's pretend like we're talking to somebody who's 2 years into fundraising and never heard of a donor advised fund. And we're going to ask you a series of questions here so that we can sort of walk people before we, the first question I want to ask you for everyone's benefit is what is a donor advised fund in say like 2 minutes?
Totally. And that's most people's response of a donor what?
Yeah.
Folks who are in philanthropy. Yeah. I was deep into the, you know, philanthropy industry before I really got to know them as well. Yeah. So all those in that category are good company. A donor advised fund is a financial account that the IRS recognizes held by a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is sort of in the advisory benefit of a donor. So assets are held by a nonprofit organization that a donor is allowed to say where they go, kind of in layman's terms. And so there are many of these. There's hundreds of donor advised funds providers, most of them small, and there's some really big ones like Fidelity, Schwab Charitable, Vanguard Charitable that have billions and billions of dollars. And if you've heard of, you know, a community foundation, most people have heard of some community foundations. Almost all community foundations provide donor advised funds, and that's kind of historically their route. Here I live in Atlanta. The Atlanta Community Foundation has been around for a long time. And so donor advised funds were created in the 1930s and originally were designed to solve kind of a tax problem of high net worth individuals when they would sell a company, let's say, and it recognize a whole bunch of income in a single tax year. And so what it allows the original use case was somebody sells a company and has a windfall of income and needs to make a donation to charity quickly. And so they can, you know, put all of these assets into a charitable fund, the donor advised fund, and receive the tax recognition for that gift up front without having to decide where that money is going to go, which organizations it's specifically going to support at that time. They can do that later. And so that was the original use case, and that's evolved from then to now a little bit, and hopefully we'll talk a little bit about that on the show today.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, I've done my homework, and I've even written about donor advised funds, but I didn't know sort of that original case. So that's very helpful. But I don't want to, and there's even a piece in there that I kind of want to go down a bunny trail, but I don't want to do that quite yet. Okay, so again, we're talking to the 2-year fundraiser. So we've got the definition of a donor advised fund. Now, what is it that your firm does, your company, your technology company? What is it you guys do as it relates to, because you are essentially a donor advised fund. So what is it you guys do?
That's right. So the way I like to tell this is just to tell a little bit of a story of my life as a nonprofit consultant. We were helping high net worth individuals be strategic about their giving. You know, for instance, we had a client that wanted to give a substantial amount of money for Syrian refugee relief. And at that time, it was a complicated endeavor, and we would provide research services to help them figure out, you know, what they should fund, how they should structure it, which organizations they should support, et cetera. And when it came time to hand them the report of like, this is what we think you should do, the donor, you know, went to their donor advice fund and said, here's the plan, execute. And that was it, that the money was deployed as we prescribed. And I was like, man, that is so easy. And my wife and I, we made a commitment years ago to give away a certain percentage of our income. And we were like, this experience for this major donor in terms of the process of giving away money is easier than mine. And they're giving 1,000x more than I am. That seems kind of odd. And so when I first discovered donor advised fund, I was kind of had the response of like, well, I want one,
right?
But I didn't feel like the existing structure made sense because I was a small dollar giver. And so the fees kind of weren't attractive, and there were minimums that I couldn't hit. And it felt like a very advanced financial product. Like, if I don't have a financial advisor alongside me, I'm probably going to get something wrong here. Yeah. That's kind of how it felt. And so Charity Vest, which is our company, is a response to kind of the historic story of donor advised funds being a product for the high net worth folks, that we are trying to create a donor advised fund that really is for everyone. It has no minimum, no fee. And in fact, when you go to our website, you won't find the words donor advised fund on our front page.
Right.
We call it a personal charitable giving fund. And so we're trying to democratize everything about a donor advised fund and give the benefits of having all your giving in one place, having one tax record for your giving, and of course, eliminating fees from giving all together, trying to give all those benefits to donors nationwide and benefit charities because we're eliminating transaction fees. We're an online modality for giving, and we have no transaction fee to the nonprofits whatsoever. And, you know, we receipt the donors on their behalf and automate all that. So we think it's a better experience for donors and for nonprofits on the receiving end as well.
Yeah. So you and I both know. Okay. So this is the point in which the podcast show gets fun. So you and I both know what the critiques are. And so again, to our 2-year relatively new fundraising professional, what are the criticisms? Why do some people think that the donor advised fund is a boogeyman trying to destroy philanthropy or something like that?
Totally. Yeah. The big kind of stat that gets thrown around is that there's $120 billion as of, you know, end of 2018, the latest numbers, sitting in donor advised funds that is not deployed to charities. And, you know, you kind of look at that and go, oh, wow. Like if the charitable space in America had $120 billion more dollars, what could happen? And you hear about, significant gifts that get made to the Silicon Valley, a community foundation in particular, gets a lot of the, you know, tough press that, money goes in there and is not going to a specific charity. So it's kind of the extension of the same. There's a lot of money sitting there. It's not being deployed to charities. And donor advised funds are growing, and they're growing fast. Over the last 5 years, it's a 17%, I think, were the latest numbers, compound annual growth rate. over the last 5 years, of donor advised fund contributions. So they're growing fast. Charitable giving is only growing at, over the last 5 years, like 3%. They're growing a lot faster. So more and more charitable giving is going into donor advised funds. And I think that, creates a bit of a, scare that like there is more and more money just going to sit there is kind of the narrative.
Yeah. So I remember reading an article. I think this was in the Chronicle of Philanthropy about 3 years ago. And it was the point at which the Fidelity's donor advised fund had. And for my listeners, please understand. And Stephen has just sort of explained this in a very good explanation of everywhere we wanted to get in 7.5 minutes or whatever. Cause that's not the funner part of this conversation. There was a point at which, Stephen, where the Chronicle of Philanthropy had noted that Fidelity's charitable gift fund had exceeded the size of – or the number of gifts that the United Way had collected. And I think maybe Fidelity's fund was raising as much in a year in terms of charitable giving as maybe as Stanford was or something. I think that's the enormity of what sort of caught my radar. But I think also what caught my radar and why I tend to be more of an advocate as opposed to a critic of the whole idea is that I'm seeing a donor who's just being more intentional. And it's interesting the way you introduced the donor advised fund back in the 1930s is essentially you were talking about somebody who has to liquidate a company very quickly and needs to and wants the advantage of a charitable deduction, but doesn't necessarily wants to also remain be able to make intentional decisions about their charitable giving that at the time they didn't have the time or the bandwidth necessarily to make.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the purpose? Is intentionality a word? This is where I'm trying to get with all my rambling. Is intentionality a word that you all own when you think about what you're trying to do for your donors?
I think that's a definite piece of the value proposition of a donor advised fund is it does unlock more intentionality. And there's a lot of literature that's been written on bad giving of like, we should slow down the haphazard giving. I think of books like When Helping Hurts and other kind of seminal works that have created a lot of, following in discussion in the nonprofit space. So we view donor advised funds as a mechanism that helps people be more intentional, that they don't have to just default to giving to their alma mater, though there's nothing wrong with that. But if it's in lieu of a thoughtful gift, we would rather see that money sit for a few months and wait for an opportunity that is a strategic opportunity for that donor to become more engaged with an issue or a cause or sort of something that they're excited about and a gift that has more strategic value than, just kind of defaulting to what they've always done.
It's interesting you bring up When Helping Hurts because everybody – so for my listeners who are not familiar, so When Helping Hurts was a book that came out, I don't know, 10 or – was it? Has it been 10 years?
Sounds right.
Yeah, about 10 years ago. And it's largely written to the Christian parachurch world, primarily probably the evangelical Christian parachurch world. And it was a critique of the way that organizations address the actual needs on the ground and who's doing the service. And it's interesting to sort of think, because I had not put that together, Stephen, until you just referenced it. But there's an article today, 20 hours ago, in the Wall Street Journal, that the title is, it's called The War on Philanthropy. If you think about it, it's sort of this ongoing critique that started with things like, When Helping Hurts, that has now gotten to the way that we raise money and how we give away money. I'm sort of piecing that together. And now I know where you're coming from too, because I didn't, when you and I talked earlier this week, I don't know that I picked up on, is your involvement with that parachurch world, is that a robust part of your history or, am I drawing some conclusions that aren't there?
Yeah, it is kind of loosely. It's never been kind of intentional that that's exclusively, you know, my focus, but certainly has been an overlap with my world. Many of our donors we work with on the consulting side were faith-based donors and sort of in that world. And there are other books like When Helping Hurts that I think are more secular focused. That was sort of one of them.
Definitely. Yeah. So take us down the path a little bit further about what it is you're trying to do, because I think when you and I sort of on the pre-record had talked about this conversation today, I was thinking about like the $1,000 a year donor, but you're actually thinking about like the $10,000 a year donor. So we're certainly not talking about the mega donor. But we're talking about a donor who, if, you know, if we're talking about the average rescue mission, the average private school that I'm oftentimes working with, or if we're talking about a small, you know, college or university, $10,000 matters. And so for that money to first go through you guys, through a program like yours, what does that mean? What does that mean for the frontline fundraiser, and how do they interact with you? And is there a, are you creating interference?
Answer that question that we get from time to time.
Yeah.
Of like, are you an intermediary here?
Yeah.
The way that we think about us, this is getting a little bit philosophical for a second,
but
we think about ourselves as an interface between donor and nonprofit. So we don't want to be a middleman, but we do want to be an interface. And our goal is to be the thinnest, slickest, most frictionless interface there is between donor and nonprofit.
Yeah.
That's our goal. And so you can think about, you know, when I say interface, when someone writes a check, that paper check is an interface between a donor, you know, supporting and that nonprofit receiving their support. Your web forms that where you collect online donations, those are interfaces, kind of at the broadest philosophical definition. And we consider ourselves one of those, and we want to do better than the paper check, and we want to do better than, you know, the online form. And so, you know, that's how we view ourselves, and we want to be more frictionless, you know, between donor and nonprofit to make more gifts happen. We think that, and our data is just starting to come in and establish this a little bit, that folks, when they do have a tool in their hands to be more intentional, do give more to the organizations they love. You know, when you think about Amazon.com, as you know, they've created this frictionless interface towards additional products in your life. There's a lot of data that shows people are buying more because it's so easy on Amazon.com. We want to do the same thing, but for giving. Make it so frictionless that giving activity becomes more of a habit. And ultimately, you know, dollar amounts on a per donor basis go up.
Oh, you know, I had never thought about that, but it is so easy. So I'm working on a second book right now, and it is so easy. So I'll be searching the web for something, you know, some thought that, and it's so easy to end up on Amazon and find a book and spend $27 on a book that otherwise, you know, it would have taken me, you know, all sorts of time and energy, you know, 5 or 10 years ago to get across town to end up at a bookstore. And in most cases, what I'm usually ordering, or most of the time what I'm reading, you know, an average bookstore is not going to be, you know, stocking. So, So what does that mean? The intentionality, what are some of the other characteristics of the donor that maybe my 2 year in fundraiser needs to understand about that donor that's using your platform? That maybe, cause I totally think that donor is the donor of the future. I'm of the opinion that the millennial, the boomer, the Gen Xer like myself, I think everyone's going to end up on platforms like you folks have that create that intentionality. The better donors, the donors we want to attract. But what else do we need to know about that donor, other than just that intentionality?
Sure. And I'll kind of hit a couple points here. I think they're important. I mean, what the growth of the donor advised fund space, I think, indicates is that donors are looking for a better interface. There are sort of interface advantages that donor advised funds get. They give donors more control over their data. They can choose whether to be anonymous or whether to, you know, release their entire, you know, home address, let's say, to nonprofits. You know, they can choose how they want to give and have full control. They trust DonorWise funds to be more secure with their financial data than they do, you know, a random small nonprofit that they just want to give a little bit of support to. So, you know, there's interface advantages to DonorWise funds. I think that's why we're seeing, you know, some of the contributes, some of the, you know, extreme growth of DonorWise funds. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of folks who learn about DonorWise funds quickly convert into them. I think awareness is like one of the major obstacles of DonorWise funds. So and particularly with, you know, the recent change in the tax code lifting the standard deduction, I think you're going to see a lot more activity into DonorWise funds. Because, you know, there's a tax strategy out there called bunching. We don't need to get into it necessarily right now, but allows folks to, you know, give multiple years of giving in a single year. And you need a donor advised fund unless you want to not support charity for a whole year. It's worth Googling, Google, you know, tax bunching.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's going to also drive more activity into donor advised funds, but kind of, you know, the second point I want to make on your question of sort of what should folks be thinking about in terms of next generation giving. I think, you know, particularly in our digital world, you know, my generation is digitally native, and, you know, the generation behind me, you know, I'm a millennial. The generation behind me never knew a world without smartphones. I can remember, you know, a world without smartphones, but particularly the next generation cannot. And so we're an increasingly digitally native world. Yeah. What we're seeing is that friction matters more and more in this world. You know, we talked about frictionlessness and, you know, yeah, how that greases the wheels, Amazon.com, et cetera, a second ago. But friction really matters in giving. And that's what we're hearing from a lot of our donors that come to us of, like, you know, we've had donors come to us to say, this nonprofit I want to support, I just can't figure out how to support them well. We had a donor come to us on December 31st and say that it was just too much pain to try to figure out how to support, you know, this nonprofit I was trying to support.
Yeah.
And so I'm just dumping it all with you guys. And it was a substantial 5-figure amount of money, you know, yeah. So it's really interesting to see, the friction with technology start mattering more and more. And I'll tell you, I spent a few years in grad school at Yale and got exposed to a little bit of the research here. And there's some research done at University of Chicago and then was followed up with some additional at Yale is how I heard about it, on giving friction specifically. The study was they gave folks $5 and invited them to either keep it or invited them to give it.
Yeah.
But with each different research group, they required them to put the $5 in a mailbox if they were going to give it away. And different control groups, they put the mailbox at different distances away from the location where they gave them the money. And what they found out was that the further away you put it, the lower participation rates in giving are. And so it establishes a strong, you know, well, I think that friction in giving participation matters a ton. And so that's part of the thesis with our venture is we really think. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's fascinating because I would sit here. Initially, we were talking about the frictionless with Amazon. But I also so in my first book, I talked a lot about how I think. So what the frictionless environment that, for example, Amazon creates is it also sort of, and Amazon knows this, as does every other enterprise of the sort, they're trying to tap into that impulsivity. And I think I could see how, and I go back to the way you started this with the individual in the 1930s, there's almost like, I think to some degree, some people may use a platform like yours to create the seamlessness of the process, but also want the friction. Like to some degree, I want some of the friction, and I don't mean friction in a negative sense. I think I'm using the word friction to sort of say, It's more of a self-control sort of thing. You know, nowadays I can get on my iPhone and if somebody's quick enough and sharp enough about whatever app they develop on that comes up through my Facebook thread or something, they can get $25 out of me, just like the Amazon site did to buy that book that I may or may not need.
Totally.
But I don't know if I want it to be that frictionless, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think the more significant the gifts, the more likely they don't want it to be, you know, I'm not giving you $10,000 with a swipe, you know, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And I would make a distinction of, you know, the decision versus the process.
Yeah. Okay.
When the folks come to us to give, they've already made a decision to give. It's just a matter of activating it.
Okay.
You know, we're trying to make the process frictionless.
Yeah.
And we have introduced the ability for them to receive tax benefits, and sort of like have a commitment device, even if they're not, receiving the tax benefits without having to make a decision of where to give yet. We want to, sort of in a way, are establishing a stopping point for them to entertain the friction a little bit, to use your terminology, to like establish a relationship or to be thoughtful about where their money is going to go, kind of back to our intentionality point.
Yeah.
But the process to fulfill a gift really seems to end up mattering quite a bit as to the sort of fulfillment of a decision to give, because we can think about that $5 experiment. I doubt there was much different in the mindset of the folks in the control group versus not.
Yeah.
You know, all of them have an intention to give. It's a matter of activating it. And I think that's really where friction starts to matter, is sort of timeliness and sort of like the amount at which people are supporting. All those sorts of things, I think that's really where friction starts to matter quite a bit in this whole equation.
Okay, so here's a little bit of a backstory on what some of my listeners have heard me say in the past, or if they've read my stuff. So I used to refer to I used to draw a distinction between. And I still think they very much exist, but it really ruffled some feathers. It's the idea of a trivial and a meaningful and a significant gift. Three different types of gifts, right? And I was, and what a lot of people have heard me say over the last 2 years is this idea of sort of this tyranny of the trivial gift, because I think there's a lot of donors out there who are being impulsively giving and consequently, but, because of the pushback that I was getting, Stephen, I started to use the word decision, just like you just did. I said, you know what? Mm-hmm. We need to clarify this. I still think there's trivial gifts out there, gifts that are not of all that. There's not a lot of meaning behind them. But what I'm critiquing is I'm saying there are people out there who are routinely giving to our organizations, making trivial decisions. And consequently, it yields a trivial gift, a less than meaningful gift. And consequently, they're not actually signaling to you that they really care about what you're doing, and they're confusing your process. And the distinction you've just drawn between process and decision is essentially what I'm trying to do on a sort of in a theoretical sense. Is you're trying to get people to have the benefit of meaningful decisions, and I guess this is just me advocating for what you guys are doing. I think what that 2-year fundraiser needs to understand is that it's very likely, if not almost assuredly, that the gift that comes through your platform is more likely to be a meaningful gift than if it didn't. Because there's far more intentionality that had to be built into the process than they just written you a check.
Totally. There's another community foundation that has been running free, no minimum donor advice funds for many years. We found out about them not long after we got started, which was really a relief to us. Like, wow, somebody's been doing this for a while. They just don't have technology like we do and have a digital interface. But one of the cool stories that they have told us is about a teacher who had a dream to be a major donor or act like one. And so saved up a lot of small gifts over a very long period of time and sort of got to a point where she funded a rather major scholarship to totally change a student's life trajectory by giving a major gift to a university on their behalf. Whereas like that would not have been possible without, you know, this donor advised fund type structure for her. In a way, it was her charitable savings account in order to do that. And that was sort of a strategic way that she wanted to concretely change somebody's life. And so that's like one story of how that's kind of played out. And so I think you do see donors get more engaged and go deeper with charities and have a means and an ability and a channel with donor advised funds to give more major gifts for sure.
Yeah. So when you guys propped this up, because you do have you are a donor advised fund, but you have an interesting business model. You had to believe, just like anybody else. I mean, I'm propping up a small enterprise myself, consulting enterprise, and I have to believe that 5 and 10 years out, what I'm doing is actually going to work. We don't deliberately jump into risks that we don't think are going to work. So what else have we not already said that sort of signals to you this idea is not going away? Because I don't think the idea, and let me offer that too. I don't think this is going away. I think if anything, there's going to be more options like what you guys are doing. I think it's fascinating what you did when I first came across what you're doing. And when I first came across what you're doing, it's kind of fascinating that you've put this additional sort of spin on the notion of donor advised fund. So what is it that sort of convinces you that 5 and 10 years out, this is just going to be a bigger thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll draw on a couple things. It may sound a little self-promotional at the beginning, just to caveat that. But really, I think this is a part of a broader trend.
Yeah.
And I'll connect those dots. Kind of one of the other things that we're doing, and I'll kind of zoom out in a second toward the industry, is we are thinking of ourselves as a payment modality for nonprofits as well. If you go on our website, we're totally donor focused today, but sort of in the near future, later in 2020, we are going to become focused on nonprofits and becoming a payment solution, particularly for small nonprofits and churches, synagogues and mosques as well. We see ourselves as sort of serving the smaller organization that doesn't have great all digital interface between donor and nonprofit, back to one of my earlier points, because we see that nobody has gotten into this fintech space to disrupt it with a model for a very, very long time. Over 90% of dollars still transact on a paper check in the nonprofit space, and today, most online giving is still riddled with, a significant transaction fee, particularly where credit cards are involved. And so, just speaking for my church, for instance, my church pays, $30,000 in transaction fees each year. And so we see a world where folks are going to enter this space and start to disrupt those models. They've been around too long, and there's a lot of good fintech and a lot of creative models out there that just haven't entered the giving space, and I think they will. And so that's kind of point number one that I want to make. Where we see the future of fintech going is driving all these transaction costs out completely. So I'll stop there. And if you have any questions, Jason, go ahead.
I'll end up distracting where you were going. So I do, I totally agree with you. I think something happened in fundraising, where we've sort of skipped. There's like a 20-year gap where fundraising, in nonprofit organizations sort of missed where things were going, and then the internet showed up. And now the internet's really starting to mature, and so I think it's kind of like what we talk about developing countries. You know, we've talked about, we could be talking about, you know, third world countries that sort of skip being a second world country and go straight to a first world context in some instances. And I think some organizations are just trying to catch up with being, you know, where we were, you know, at the dawn of the internet. And there's so many newer sort of upstart charitable organizations that are just totally way beyond that. Let's stick with you, and not let it distract where you were going.
Yeah. I think kind of the two big trends here to sort of key in on are, I think things are going to become more donor focused. I think, I've heard you talk about donors becoming more demanding. I don't know if that's kind of the right verb, but their sort of expectations are higher. Relationships are starting to matter more. Yeah. You know, said another way, fundraising costs are increasing, not just financial, but what it takes to sort of get donors on board is increasing. And I think, because of that, technology is going to play a bigger and bigger role. You know, you think about not just, you know, payment interfaces like I was talking about, but even, you know, things like donor relationship management systems and sort of becoming more sophisticated and helping tools that help people be more thoughtful, playing a bigger role. I think things are going to become more donor focused is kind of the big point here. And I would even say that's part of the reason why donor advised funds are kind of increasing, to sort of put another data point in that column is because it allows the donor to kind of, you know, be more in control. And I think that'll continue. The second is just the general role of technology in the relationship period, back to our digital, increasingly digital world point. We're just seeing folks be digitally native, and, you know, finance as a category is becoming more digitally native on the consumer side. And I think expectations are increasing for nonprofits. And the challenge I think nonprofits face is they don't typically have the resources internally to create that technology. And frankly, historically has not been an attractive space from a profit pool perspective for lots of great tech minds to enter and create thoughtful technology. And so, you know, I think we're going to see that start to change as fundraising costs go up and, I think profit pools are going to get bigger, and I think folks are going to, start entering the space, and we're going to see more and more, financial technology and relationship technology really start to play out in the space.
Yeah, go a little further on that point, because I think there was something you said a few moments ago, and then there's where you ended there, that last point. So, and I'll tell you why I want you to go a little further on that, because I think what you guys are probably picking up on is this distinction. So I tend to be of the opinion that fundraising has, let's see if this makes sense to you. You're a smart guy. Fundraising has reached its peak efficiency. It's not going to get any cheaper, and it's not going to get any easier, and it's going to have to get more responsive. That's why I use the word responsive. And technology is going to actually enable us to do that. And I think when we talk about some of the organizations that are out there that are listening to this podcast, I think they're still under the impression that when you bring technology in, that it's that the innovation technology brings is to make it more efficient. When in fact, I think it's going, most of what we're going to, like for instance, the conversation you and I are having here. This is facilitating the engagement. I think about a conversation I had earlier today. I have never been in the room with the guy, but he referred to me as a friend, and as like we've gotten to know each other, and it was as if we had been in the room multiple times. So I don't know that it's going to make things any more efficient or quicker. Are you guys sort of thinking the same way? I have to imagine you are.
Yeah, totally. I think it is going to make things, to some degree more efficient, but I think also we got to think about technology making things more effective as well. I think about right now, we're living in the information age, I've heard kind of folks talk about the next evolution as, you know, the analytical age of like, you know, information is not that valuable. What's valuable is analyzed information. And I think we're going to see, you know, an increasing amount of, you know, information being able to be processed in the nonprofit space. I can tell you, you know, when we roll out our nonprofit side of our platform, one of the things that we know we will create is analytics for a nonprofit organization for their own donor base. And we're going to create cross-organization analytics, and sort of we'll be able to tell organizations what their giving share of wallet is compared, you know, for their average donor, and sort of give them marketing information. That's one of the things that sort of is in our product roadmap. And I think you're going to see more and more of that, you know, as data becomes more available and analytics is cheaper.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is one of the mega trends that I've heard talked about in technology is the next evolution beyond analytics is intimacy. And this is a little bit more meta.
Yeah.
Okay. But sort of like, you know, that's going to be the precious commodity in a world in which everybody's connected via zeros and ones with their smartphones and apps and such, that the most precious commodity is being known on a deeper level.
Yeah.
And I think at that point that becomes, you know, technology is going to enable us to know preferences of people on a meaningful level. And that's really where, you know, deep analytics and AI can come in, and assist our human sensibilities to form meaningful relationships. And we want to be thoughtful about that, not just as our venture, but how we relate to the world and not just sort of make things transactional, but think about how to interface donor and nonprofit to where they have a more meaningful relationship and that they know each other on a deeper level. And, you know, there is a thinner layer between, you know, the person who's donating and the person that's benefiting with their money all the way at sort of the end of the quote unquote nonprofit value chain, that there is greater intimacy. That's sort of really how we think philosophically all this is headed. And I think technology is going to assist it all the way along, all that to say.
Yeah, totally. We could go. Yeah. I mean, you said a keyword. Yeah, that's kind of what I was looking for there. And your thinking is that, that intimacy point, I think is where technology is going to push us. You know, I hear people out there talking about it. Another big mega thought is this idea of proximity and what proximity is doing, because proximity is now defined differently. It's not geographically defined. And so the closeness, the intimacy that is now created through a platform like you and I are using for this conversation sort of redefines those limits or those boundaries, and allows two individuals or a group of individuals to build a more intimate relationship. And I think when we go back to the notion of can organizations learn and can they learn quickly enough? See, like, you know, when you were saying a few minutes ago, the idea of sort of being in the information age versus the analytical, I think you still got people that are sort of fascinated with information, but once information is so vast, you know, and the other thing is everybody's got the information. In a company like yours, I guarantee you there's companies out there, and I know, and I know exactly who they are, and I'm sure you know who they are too, that don't even see you guys coming. And so the capabilities, it's fascinating stuff. So Stephen, I've got to let you go. I've held you a long time, longer than most of my listeners will hold on for. If they're interested in learning more about what it is you guys are doing, can you point them in some right directions?
Totally. CharityVest, just as it sounds, charityvest.org. You can find us. You'll see kind of the ability to create a personal giving fund for free. Would love you folks to go and test drive it. Totally free. We don't charge anything to you. Don't charge anything to nonprofits you support. We make money by functioning like a bank, by holding the assets and making very low risk investments with them. And would invite any, you know, folks out there that represent nonprofits to reach out to us. We are looking for partners to grow with, and we would love to be a giving solution for your organization, and we won't charge you a dime. We would love to just partner with you to help your mission along. And I would just say as a closing thought to all the folks out there, back to our original topic, you know, about donor advised funds being a scary thing. I would encourage you to think about donor advised funds as something useful and, as a tool, and would invite anyone to, you know, talk further with me. Feel free to email us through our website to talk more about donor advised funds and how you might be able to get involved closer to donor advised funds, you know, and meet donors there rather than, you know, being scared of it. I think it's an asset in donors' hands, and the pie will get bigger for everybody.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.